Hola, Andres.
Hello, Anand. It's a pleasure.
The pleasure is mine. So today my guest is Andres Weintraub. He's a full professor at the Department of Industrial Engineering of the University of Chile. His main research areas are OR, operations management in forestry and mining, as well as logistics and transportation. He has published over 90 papers in recognized journals, including Operations Research, Management Science, Forest Science, and EJOR. He has also edited several books and journal issues on topics related to OR in forestry and mining. He has carried out multiple projects with industry and governmental organizations and has received many recognitions, which include the Chilean National Prize for Applied Science, the Harold Lardner Prize given by the Canadian OR Society, the Informs Presidential Prize, and the gold medal from the Chilean Institute of Engineering. He was awarded a Doctor Honoris Causa from the University of Agricultural Sciences of Sweden and the Laval University in Canada. He is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Engineering and the Chilean National Academies of Science and of Engineering, and he is also an Informs Fellow. He was a co-founder and former president of ALIU, which is the Latin American Association of OR, and president of iForce. Andres, you are one of the pillars of OR here in Latin America. Beyond that, you are a true gentleman and for sure one of the nicest figures in our community. It's an incredible honor to have you here. Muchas gracias.
Look, Anand, thank you for your warm introduction. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to you about the history of OR in Latin America.
It's fantastic. So you were born in December 1942 in Santiago, and according to your website, your original name is not Andres.
Yeah, that's funny. My mother, she enjoyed very much French movies, so she gave me a French name, Félix André, which was terrible in Chile. Everybody called me Andres, so it was fine. But I started having problems with my credit cards, hotel reservations. So at some point, decades ago, I decided to change legally my name, which is now Andres, with an S, not André. Mm-hmm. And I kept the Felix just in case, so people looking at my old name would see, okay, the two names are still there.
So Weintraub is a typical Jewish German surname. Did your parents come from Germany or other part of Europe?
They came from Vienna, Austria. Ah. And they came to Chile just in time, 1938. Hitler had just annexed Vienna, Austria, and obviously it was very dangerous for Jews at the time. And the reason we came to Chile, and my family was lucky, there was a brother of my mother who had come to South America in the 20s. And he was very successful. He lived in Ecuador. And he got visas for everybody and could support them at the start. And they all were supposed to live in Quito, where he lived. But my grandmother, she had a heart condition. And the doctor said there's no way she can live in that altitude. So they discussed about it. There were five brothers and sisters. In the end, they said my mother and my father would come to Chile with my grandmother. So by those fates of history of your life, that I ended up in Chile, of which I'm very grateful. Both my parents and I have had a great life here.
Yeah. And the Latin American OR community is also very grateful. So, what were your parents' jobs in Austria and then in Chile?
My father was a lawyer, and my mother did what's called a doctorate in French letters. It's really just 5 years, but at that time, PhDs in Europe didn't really exist. And when they came to Chile, my father couldn't be a lawyer. I mean, it's a language, different laws. So that's unfortunate because he became a very successful businessman. Mm-hmm. And my mother basically was a homemaker, but she had many interests in literature, in many other things. So she, in that sense, she had a very full life, intellectually.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And how was life in Santiago from the late 1940s until the early 1960s? How did you spend your time?
It was so different from now. I had a very happy childhood. No TV, no cells, nothing like that. What we did was basically play football, soccer, talk to friends, read a lot, go to the movies once a week or twice a week, and once you were old enough, 14, 15, start going out with girls. So it was a very rich, relaxed childhood. At that time, Santiago was very safe. When I was 8, 9 years old, my parents realized, this child understands how to move around. So I went on my own. I went to school, I would take the bus, and there was no danger. That was so nice about it. There were no cars almost, so we'd play football all day long in the street, and maybe every half hour a car would come, we would stop, and then start again. Mm-hmm. That's one part of life where I'm so happy I lived in that time as a child and not now.
Well, one can tell that you were very happy growing up there. So did you have the chance to visit Europe in those days, in the 1950s?
Yeah, well, my father was, as I told you, a very successful businessman. And in 1953, they wanted to go to Europe. I have family there. My father had a sister who lived in London and another who lived in Tel Aviv. So we went to visit. Now, those were, there were no jets, was rotor engines, much slower. They couldn't fly very long. So our trip went to Santiago, Buenos Aires, bad weather in Buenos Aires, so we had to go back and spend the night in Mendoza, back to Buenos Aires, then Montevideo, Rio, then Recife.
Wow.
Because they couldn't fly directly from Rio to Africa. So it was Recife, Dakar, and Dakar, Madrid. So it took us 3 days to get from Santiago to Madrid.
So you landed in Recife, which is just next door, about 120 kilometers from João Pessoa. And I'm very pleased to know that. Great. Well,
actually, we just had holidays 2 years ago in Recife. It's beautiful.
So
beautiful.
You missed visiting us in João Pessoa again.
Next time, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, Claudio Contardo, who is also from Chile, and he was also here as a guest last year, told me that you were a huge soccer fan. And you were even part of the board of Universidad de Chile. A famous soccer team from Santiago. Since we're talking about the 50s and 60s, I wonder if you had a chance to attend some matches of the 1962 World Cup in Chile.
Yes, actually, I had a ticket for all the games that play in Santiago. Wow. So Chile did very well. We're not a powerhouse in football, but we came in third. And I saw the semifinal against Brazil. We lost 4-2. And then for the third place, it was very interesting. We're tied 0-0 against Yugoslavia. And at that time, you could not make substitutions. And three of our players were hurt. They still stayed there, but basically they couldn't do much. So it was 8 against 11. There were maybe 10 minutes left. And the Yugoslavians said, okay, let's not worry too much. We'll wait for the additional 30 minutes and then we'll kill them. And with 1 minute left, in a desperation attack, a Chilean shot from maybe 35 meters out. It would have been an easy catch for the goalie, but at the last 10 meters, it hit a defender and it went the other way, and it was a goal. And you can imagine how we celebrated the third place. And I had the privilege to see one of the great, great teams, Brazil, even without Pelé.
Yeah.
Who got hurt in the second game was clearly superior to every other team. Mm-hmm. I saw it against Chile. I saw it in the final against Czechoslovakia, which they won 3-1. And it was a marvelous team. So imagine if they had Pelé on top of that.
Yeah.
And we talked about it. I saw one of the best players ever, Garrincha,
mm-hmm.
never really played in Europe, so he's not well known. He's by far the best right wing I've ever seen. He was unstoppable.
Yes.
They would put two defenders on him still. I mean, they couldn't stop him.
Yeah. He died relatively young. He had some problems. He's a legend. In Brazil, he's very famous. But since, as you said, he did not play abroad, he's not as famous as Pelé, of course. But he was one of the main responsible players to make Brazil successful in that World Cup, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. And do you think that the World Cup left any positive impact in Chile?
It did. First, there had been an earthquake a year before, a heavy earthquake. I mean, like 8.7.
Wow.
It was in the south. It destroyed one city, Valdivia. In Chile, it had lots of effect. But one thing, it united the country. We have to be ready for the World Cup. And things were fixed quite quickly. It gave some structure to the country to be better organized, to work better. And it also helped the Football Federation. I mean, this was serious. We prepared very seriously with a very good coach for 3 years. And it improved the structure of the Football Association.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we did not become much better. I mean, like, that third place in the World Cup was once in a lifetime, until the last generation of the last 10, 12 years, where we went to America Cups, a great generation again, two finals against Argentina. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough, I was in both. Wow. One was in Santiago, that's obvious. And the other one, I had some trip to the States for some due to some conference. And then I would visit my son, who was teaching at Columbia. And also my nephew was living there and asked me, well, I see you'll be in New York at the same time of the final. Do you want to come? Sure, probably I'll see Argentina, Uruguay, or Argentina, Brazil. And it turned out it was again, Chile, Argentina. So I had the privilege of seeing both finals.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time in 100 years that we win the America Cup.
Yeah.
And one funny thing is, in both finals, I was there with my grandson, who was maybe 9 years old, 10 years old. And at that time, he thought Chile wins always.
Ah.
He doesn't know it's going to take another 100 years to win.
Yeah. Well, let's change topics a little bit now. You joined university in early 1960s. Was engineering your first choice?
As far as I remember being in high school, I never thought anything else as engineering. Also at that time, you have now so many choices. At that time, good students thought about medicine, law, and engineering. Maybe also dentistry, lower, economy, a bit lower, business administration. But those three careers were the basic ones. Mm-hmm. And among those three, obviously, for me, engineering was always the clear choice.
Right. OR was a relatively young field during the 1960s, especially here in South America. How did you come across the subject?
It was, again, fate. The system in Chile is 6 years. It hasn't really changed. The first 2 years are common, the basic stuff, mathematics, physics, etc. In third year, you have to make a choice, civil engineering, mechanical, chemical. And I was lost. I didn't know what to do. And some people commented, the tough guys to go to electrical engineering. So I said, I'm a tough guy, I'll go there. By the time I was in fifth year, I realized this is not what I like. I was terrible in labs. Nobody wanted to do labs with me. I would destroy them, the machines. I was very, very clumsy. And I didn't really enjoy that much. And a friend of mine who was in industrial engineering told me, look, there is a new class called operations research, which is given now for the first time. Why don't you take it next year? I took it. The professor was great, Eduardo Schwartz. Mm-hmm. He was later a famous researcher in finance. He was president of the U.S. Association of Finance. He ended up his career in UCLA. and it changed my life. I loved it. Later we became friends and I told him the story. And I did my thesis in operations research. After I finished, I was hired by the telecommunications company. And I said, besides the typical work, I'm going to do my thesis in a theme is building an optimal network of telecommunications for Chile using OR. My boss was the head of the chair of the thesis. He had no idea of OR. The other members of the committee have a very vague idea. So nobody realized there was a huge error in my thesis, which I realized once I started my PhD in Berkeley. So I got the top grade and I was very happy with it. And I didn't know it was completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And since I liked OR so much, I said, well, I always had behind my head the idea that I would go and get a PhD in the US. So I said, okay, it should be OR. And that's what I applied for, to mm-hmm. go to do a PhD in OR.
Mm-hmm. You said you wrote a thesis to graduate. Did you have to code?
Yes, I had to code. And nobody really looked very much at my code, and I'm jumping ahead. For my PhD thesis, I also had to code. And a friend of mine who knew computer science looked at the code, said, Andres, this is the worst code I've ever seen. No talent whatsoever. And that was the last time I coded, because I know it's a weakness. So whenever I do anything, I have other people coding.
Okay. You mentioned you applied to some universities in the U.S. For higher studies. Which of them you applied?
Well, at that time, the world wasn't global. I mean, we had little idea of the rest of the world. And I had this idea, I would like to go to California. And somebody had mentioned Berkeley and Stanford at the top universities. They're really top universities in the US. So I'll apply to them. And I may not get in, so why don't I apply to a second-rate university also, University of Southern California. I was accepted at Berkeley and Stanford, and not at USC. Many years later, I had friends at USC. I said, how come Berkeley and Stanford took me in and you didn't? He was older than me. He was there at the time. He said, look, we didn't even know where Chile was. We would never take somebody from a country that, don't forget, it was not a global world. We didn't know Chile existed. So how could we take a guy from Chile? It shows you how the world has changed. Mm-hmm. Everything was done by letter.
Mm-hmm.
Phones were outrageously expensive. Obviously no internet. Telegrams, we used to send, it was mostly telegrams, it was something very urgent, short, or letters.
Mm-hmm.
So then it was either Berkeley or Stanford. I went there married, I just married.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, who's a brilliant person, she had done 1 year engineering and 2 years sociology here, so she had to finish her bachelor. And Stanford, I went there, you know, to have a look. I had no idea Berkeley, Stanford, and to have an idea what should she do also. So Stanford had a policy to do your bachelor, you need at least 2 years residence, but she had already done three, and Berkeley would accept one. So we went to Berkeley.
Okay.
It was a great choice. I mean, it was really, we went there in a very interesting time.
Mm-hmm.
It was the hippie movement, the free speech movement, the opposition to the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
It was really moving politically.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to Berkeley, and she finished her bachelor's in sociology. And she went to an advisor in the bachelor, said, oh, after I do this, I want to do my PhD in sociology. And this bachelor said, the guy who was tutoring her said, there's no way. We don't accept students from the same university. It's still there. I mean, you want students to move.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we weren't even that concerned about it, which would, what will we do? I mean, I'm doing the PhD here. What will you do? And eventually she did so well, even though she was didn't really speak much English, that much English, mm-hmm. that not only did they accept it for the PhD, they gave her a fellowship, wow. 5-year fellowship. Wow. And once she did her, she went up to the qualifying in sociology and took statistics as a minor. And remember, she did 1 year engineering, so she was very good at math. So she liked it very much, and she decided to switch back to statistics. So in the end, she did her PhD in statistics.
Okay.
So she has a very strong background. I mean, I think she's probably one of the few persons who has a PhD in statistics, but has studied Marx and Weber and all of those famous. I mean, not just read them, studied them in class.
She should be a very brilliant person for sure. You had to do GRE to apply to universities in the U.S. And how was your English back then?
My English was extremely good.
Oh.
Besides the English taught in high school, I took lessons, one lesson a week for maybe, I don't know, 8 years. And the system of the professor was very good. We would chat. And whenever a word came out I didn't know, she would write it down, maybe 10, 12, 15 words a week. And I had to learn them. Mm-hmm. And I had to know them all the time. So at any point, she would take any word for the last 4 years, and I had to know it. Mm-hmm. So by the end of those 6-7 years that I was with her, my English was pretty good. And I remember, I still remember, I mean, I did very well in the math GRE, like top 1%. But in the English GRE, I was like top 12%.
Wow.
Competing with Americans.
Yeah.
Well, my English must have been very good.
Yes, absolutely.
I was reading English at the time, I remember. Uh-huh. So that's why I guess I got in pretty well, uh-huh. pretty well in Stanford and Berkeley.
Right. You mentioned the hippie movement when you arrived there. And since you were staying very close to San Francisco, I wonder if you met gentle people with flowers in their hair when you got there.
I met them.
Yeah.
It was such a crazy period. I remember at the beginning we're there walking Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, and we couldn't believe our eyes. We came from a very conservative society. Chile at the time, probably Brazil also, was very conservative. Not now. And we see naked people in the street with flowers and living the hippie life.
Uh-huh.
And what's a bit tragic about it, it didn't last, that's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it wasn't even, it was just a few places. For example, you would be on campus and you'd hear these very radical speeches, but you went maybe 10 blocks away and it wasn't there.
Oh.
It was just the youth, more the youth in colleges that were so radical.
Mm-hmm.
Once I met one guy, later in work, would be a weatherman.
Mm.
Those were the violent people. They would put, he was setting up bombs. And looking back, said I was crazy at the time. I mean, it was violent and it had no future in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a movement which was very interesting, but lasted maybe 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went away and it changed completely. I mean, you look at US society in the 80s, it's already a completely different society.
Right. Did you have any difficulties to adapt to the new reality, both academically and personally speaking?
Not really. There were many Chileans. There was a plan Chile, California. So there were many Chileans studying there. We all lived in a village, small apartments that were used for housing military during the Second World War. Our apartment must have been maybe 30, 35 meters. But we live very happily. I mean, when you're young, mm-hmm. any place is fine. We had happy years there. Well, we were nostalgic about Chile, and we thought eventually we'll go back. But obviously, we had to sort of finish this stage of studies.
Yeah. Did you have to do any research and write your dissertation to earn your master's degree in statistics?
No, it was just an exam.
Uh-huh.
Basically, what happened was as taking a minor in statistics, somehow I realized if I take three more courses, I'll get a master. So I did it.
Ah, okay.
It did really help me. I never worked really with statistics later.
Uh-huh.
And doctorates at the time were shorter, three and a half years. And basically, we did not do research like we do now just at the start. We first do our comprehensive, where you decide, are you going on to the PhD or just a master's, and then a qualifying.
Mm-hmm.
And once you did the qualifying, which was usually after 2 years, then you started your thesis.
Okay. And what was your research about?
Well, now, in the last 20 years or so, you go to a professor and they tell you, okay, I'm working on these topics, work with me on this. At that time, we had no idea how to do a thesis, so I went to several professors, and they told me, well, start reading and come up with an idea. That's all the guidance I got. So I started reading, and somehow I got the idea, working networks, and it ended up something like a paper which was quite well known, like, about if you take the most negative cycle in a solution, you eventually, in a finite number of steps, you'll get to a solution.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there were theorems I needed. And I still remember I was sort of thinking about the most difficult part. And I was at the swimming pool, Strawberry Canyon, in the summer. And suddenly it hit me. It's something that happened in seconds. I was walking to go into a swimming pool, and it hit me. So I wrote all the theorems. And I went to see Richard Karp, which is a very well-known researcher in rhetorics. Yeah. And I wrote in the blackboard at that time all my theorems and said, no, this is very good. And let's do it now computationally. Let's do it. So basically, he helped me in the second part enormously. Just knowing him, talking to him was an experience. And in the end, so in the last half year or so, I did all the experimental stuff. And as I told you, my coding was so bad. Usually you put the times.
Yeah.
I mean, you put, as a result, I did the number of steps because the times were meaningless. I mean, it was a huge amount of time to write. And I didn't know how to write a paper. So remember the first time I wrote, so a first draft, Richard told me, this is not draft one, this is draft zero. And he taught me, it took some months, he taught me to write, how to write a paper.
Wow.
And then I finished, I sent the paper to Management Science, and then, finally, I wrote another paper, also based on a similar vein. Mm-hmm. And one nice thing that happened, it's a colleague of mine, actually was a student, he proved that about incompleteness with my algorithm, and he gave it the name, which was like a nice gesture to a friend, on Weintraub's negative cycle. So my name was on the title of his paper. That was a nice gesture.
Yeah, absolutely. It was around that time he was doing a groundbreaking research on computational complexity of combinatorial problems. Were you aware that history was being made at that time?
No, that was funny. We're a group, maybe five, six students working with him, and he would present the results, and we'd look at each other and say, yeah, this looks nice. We're not aware. We're so naive. We're not aware that it was groundbreaking work. We didn't realize that.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Actually, compared to the students now, we're very naive. I mean, I see students now, they're doing their PhD thesis, and they're already thinking 5 years ahead. They are so much more sophisticated. They know the world so much better. We're just thinking, well, let's do our thesis and then we'll see what we do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I noticed that you published a couple of papers from your PhD as a sole author, those that you just mentioned now.
Yeah.
Was there any particular reason for that?
Well, we talked a bit with Richard Karp. Basically, the main thesis I've done on my own. I mean, I thanked him, but he had just done, sort of helped me with the computational part. So he thought, I mean, I was naive. I didn't really know how to. He thought, no, this you should publish on your own, because all the theoretical work was done by you. When you came to me, the thesis was practically done. All we needed were the computational examples, things like that. Mm-hmm. And the other one I thought on my own. I think I was finishing my thesis. I didn't work with Richard at that point.
Okay, right. And after completing your PhD, you did not return to Chile straight away. Yeah. What did you do?
Well, I had to wait for my wife in Berkeley. We're talking about 1971. There was a huge recession. There were, at the time, the university would usually come to Berkeley, to campus, to interview students. Nobody came that year. There were no jobs available. I even called high schools willing to teach math. And then, again, fate, like Eduardo Schwartz, that took me to OR. There was a note, U.S. Forest Service wanted a half-time person in OR. So I applied. I would apply to anything. And it turned out the person who was looking for an assistant was Daniel Navin. He worked at U.S. Forest Service, and he built the first LP used in planning in forestry for the U.S. Forest Service. Mm-hmm. And it was used for actual planning the cycle of the 70s. The U.S. Forest Service plans every 10 years at that time. And it's very interesting how it came about. The Forest Service owns the lands, but they lease them to companies who cut it, who harvest. And there was a huge pressure from the companies to lease more land. In order to fight this, this Congress passed a law: when you plan, you must plan in such a way of non-declining yields that you know that you have enough timber that the production will never go down. And they were planning using simulation. Now, the feasible region was very small. And in simulation, you propose solutions and the simulation tells you how it works out. They couldn't find feasible solutions. So that gave the idea to Daniel, let's do linear programming. And that worked. So, and it was so successful that Congress passed another law that it was called Timberram, that all regions in the U.S., 13 regions, have to use Timberram to do their planning.
Wow.
So you had a law in Congress, you need to use OR to plan. And when I got there, we started working on mixed integer programming. Road building was about 40% of the costs, of operational costs. And they would plan it separately. The harvesters would say, okay, this one to a harvest. And the road builders would say, okay, this is the best network, road network. And we could prove that if you integrate the decisions, you get much better solutions. Now, at the time, I mean, we're talking about the mid-70s, late 70s, computers and software were much worse. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. It has been proven that every 15 years, with software and hardware improvement, the power of solution time grows by a million. So you can imagine what we had there. So any mixed integer program was very difficult to solve. We had to do heuristics, etc. So I worked a lot on mixed integer programming, and with Daniel and other people. And for the cycle of the 80s, several regions used our mixed integer program to do the planning.
Very impressive. Yeah. You left Chile in a democracy. And when you returned, you found the country under a dictatorship regime. Salvador Allende was killed and Pinochet took the power. Therefore, I assume you did not have an easy start when you joined the Universidad de Chile as a faculty member in 1974.
No. I mean, from 1974 to 1989, it was difficult. The president of the university was a general. And we had to spend a significant time I mean, percentage of our time with the political issues. Engineering, unfortunately, as a profession is strong in Chile. And engineers, even though they belong to the government, they were pro Pinochet, there was something about the profession that would protect us, as opposed in other areas. I mean, the human sciences, sociology, they were destroyed. But as far as I remember, nobody was ever expelled from our academic, from our faculty because of political views. We would protect them. But still, especially industrial engineering, we were producing the future managers. So many people say it's impossible. How can we allow industrial engineering department producing the future managers, and they have leftists in the group? So it was a fight. And but we did well. We could keep it, but it took a lot of energy and time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I remember I was associate dean. It was already in the mid-80s. It was when it was a lot. I mean, the dictatorship was very tough at the beginning, but slowly it became softer and softer. And I was associate dean, and the government named not a general as president, but a civilian, because the generals hadn't really got involved too much, but with instructions, I mean, destroy the left at the university. And we went on strike for the first time.
Mm.
And there were huge battles between the students and the police. I mean, at some point, I mean, our faculty looked like a country at war. I mean, heavy gases, and the students would throw Molotov bombs, and then the police would respond. But there was a rule that the police does not go into the campus. And I remember I was associate dean at the 8th floor, looking around, seeing all the smoke, you know. And suddenly I see students running from different directions towards our building. Why are they running here? And then I see the police coming up, and they had entered the university. And they came up to our floor to seek protection. And we put them in a big conference room, and then the police came. And I went to the stairs, and I had instructions. You have to look tough. I put my jacket. I was much younger, so they wouldn't confuse me with a student. And when the police came up, I said, "Where is your commander? Where is your commander?" And they went up, and they would say, "He's coming." And all the police came up. Nothing happened. Then a minute later, the captain or whatever he was, the colonel, came up. He was a fat guy, huffing and puffing. I mean, he couldn't even. He was so tired. And the first thing he tells me, complain, "What happened to the elevator?" Which was not working, I guess. So everybody came up running, this 8 floors, but he wanted to take the elevator. I mean, he was in very bad shape. And then we had to work out, I mean, taking the students, they took always students to the prisons. They did not do any physical harm to them. I have to accept that. I mean, they were there. We want to take them out. And again, they told us, I mean, you're the dean. I was acting dean at the time. You have to be tough. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to see my students. And the policemen, the first, were very rough at me also. But they took me, and as I got to higher level police, they were much nicer. And the head of the police headquarters, he was studying law, or he was a lawyer. He was very nice to me. I said, "I know these kids. I mean, they're just kids. I mean, and I thought, I mean, if all the guys in the Pinochet really were like him, it would have been different."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I feel sorry you had to go through all of that. But
yeah. Finally, mm-hmm. That's important. This president, Federici, he tried to kick out many people. Now, as in Brazil, the university is very bureaucratic. And then now we use the bureaucracy in our favor. Okay, you want to fire this? It took months of paperwork.
Uh-huh.
And by the time we had we managed to kick this guy out.
Ah.
And people would say to Pinochet, you must support him. This will be your first defeat, and might be the beginning of the end. And in a way it was. This was the first time Pinochet was defeated. Now, it was the last few years anyway.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't really that dangerous to us. I mean, the hard, cruel, tyrannic power of the military was not really effective anymore. Too many people were against it. Even the business people were against it mm-hmm. by then. So
it fell apart eventually.
Yeah. My wife would call them. We were there in the 8th floor. It was 9 in the evening. The secretary would laugh at us, say, "Oh, these guys, they all think they're heroes." But she would take it jokingly.
Right.
But I mean, it was a difficult time. Sometimes we get together, like people who were together in the war, and they have remembrances. Remember when we did this? I mean, it was a good fight.
Mm-hmm.
And we preserved the academic freedom. That was, we're very proud about it. But academic was terrible. Usually your first 10 years in academia are the strongest ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're fighting for tenure, etc. Because of the effort, the energy we had to devote to this. Plus, we were alone, there was no internet, no funding. My 10 first years are the weakest by far, the weakest in my CV. I had some publications, but I really started doing much better later in the 80s.
Come on, you were busy saving your students and some of the faculty members too. So that was for a good cause for sure. But how did you manage to still do relevant research during the 70s and 80s, despite all adversities?
I was very lucky. I worked with the U.S. Forest Service. And when we came back in 1974, we had established a very good relationship. We like working together. So I kept one quarter time. So I would do the work in Chile and fly to Berkeley about twice, three times a year to show the results, discuss future work, etc. So they kept me in the loop, because for other people it was, today it's impossible to imagine it. With the internet, you're in any place, you're in the world. At that time, we're isolated. So I think without that, I don't know if I'd been able to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there in the US, I had money to go to conferences. So while it wasn't that productive, still I could manage to keep up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then in the mid 80s, I started working much better. There were funding. CONICET was which is like CNPq in Brazil, mm-hmm. like NSF in the US, they started funding our research, so it became much better.
Mm-hmm. But you still had to face some political issues at that time. For example, you once had your visa declined when trying to attend a Euro conference in Hungary.
Well, yeah. That was the hard period in the late 70s, and Chile had no relationships with all the Soviet countries. And there was a European meeting in Hungary, in Budapest. And I just couldn't go. I couldn't get a visa to go there.
Wow.
And that's an interesting point. In dictatorships, left wing, right wing, usually academics are the opposition. Academics tend to be liberal Democrats. So my advice or my idea is, don't punish the academics. Because in my view, academics are fighting for the good cause. Look about Nelson. I mean, he fought much more than I did. Mm-hmm. But usually, and you talk to people, I mean, basically an academic, I mean, cannot really work with open ideas. I mean, you cannot be a fanatic in an academic.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot be in a hard line and be a good academic. You must have an open mind
mm-hmm.
and respect everybody and different opinions. So that makes us, for the most, believe in democracy and respect different ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very nice piece of advice, and I completely agree with that. In 1980, you co-founded ALIU alongside Nelson Maculan, who was here as a guest, and Ugo Skolnick. How did that happen?
Well, basically, actually, I think Ugo was the first serious OR person in Argentina, Nelson in Brazil, and me in Chile. And we're the same age. So we started meeting. I was invited at the Buenos Aires conference, where I met for the first time in late 70s with Nelson. And we saw each other. We also saw each other in European, US conferences. And there was this idea we should do something in Latin America. But the spark of it was in 81, I think it was, Nelson organized a beautiful meeting in Rio. And it was done at a nice hotel on the beach. It was great. And we had also Europeans. I remember Balash was there and other great people. And we were there, great lectures. I mean, the sea, it was marvelous. We discussed, we have to come back here. Why don't we create the Latin American Association? I mean, it wasn't that trivial, but I mean, that was the spark. So Nelson said, yeah, let's do that. Now, we knew the first meetings would be very few people from other places, but let's do it with a Brazilian Sobrapo meeting. Mm-hmm. So Nelson tells us, okay, let's talk to Roberto Galvao, who's the president, who's organizing the meeting. Mm-hmm. And Roberto, unfortunately, is not with us mm-hmm. anymore. Mm-hmm. So we went to Roberto and explained the idea. He said, yeah, that's fine, let's do it. The next meeting next year is in Sao Paulo. So he said, no, not Sao Paulo, Rio, to the beach. In exchange, you will be the first president. That's how it worked. The first meeting, there were maybe all the Brazilians and maybe 12, 15 people from other countries. That's how it started. And then it grew. Now you have meetings with us. I mean, it's great. I mean, you see, we lay down the basis. And now it's large meetings, 800, 1,000 people. They have other activities like summer schools. I mean, I'm very proud that we started this Latin American organization, which now is quite important.
Yeah, and we are very thankful for that. A beautiful and fantastic initiative that made us all benefit from that. Speaking of Valio, do you have any stories involving iForce? You even became president later of iForce.
Yes, in the 80s, I don't remember exactly, it was the Malvinas War, or Falkland.
Falkland, yeah.
Falkland, Malvinas. And I think it was for 1984, iForce meeting was supposed to be in Buenos Aires. Now the board was, so the British had majority. They said, no, it's going to be very awkward for us to go to Buenos Aires after the Malvinas Falkland War. So they arbitrarily moved it to Washington. And one of the first decisions we made as ALU were boycotting. We were rejecting this change of venue. We're boycotting Washington. And we made it public. We wrote to them, we're not going. And they took it seriously. And before Washington, I had a meeting. There was some Euro meeting, I was there. The president of iForce was Heinrich Müller-Mürbach, with whom I became good friends later, but I got him there. Said, oh, this is terrible. We need Latin America. I guarantee you the next meeting will be in Buenos Aires. So that's how we went back into iForce, and yes, the next meeting was in Buenos Aires, and actually it was a good change because in 84 the military was still there, and 87 was democracy, and actually Alfonsín, the president, inaugurated the meeting. So in that sense, it was a good change for us. But that's how we started our relationship, ALU, and then it was excellent. I mean, since then, ALU had an excellent relationship with iForce. We are one of the strong continents. There's the North America, Canada, Canada, U.S., Europe, Asia Pacific, which is India, Japan, China, New Zealand, Africa. Africa is unfortunately very weak, but iForce is very, very strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad it turned out well after that incident in the 80s. Andres, you were a pioneer when it comes to OR in forestry. You even won the prestigious Edelman Award for an application in forestry, and many other recognitions. Tell me more about your most relevant contributions in such field.
I would divide it into two phases. One was more theoretical, which I did with many co-authors who are actually friends now in the US and Europe, in developing different problems. I started mixing into the programming, multi-criteria, hierarchical programming, then stochastic, now I'm working with fires. And now some of these things are applied. Operations research in forestry has been very successful. It's widely being used. Not everything. Multi-criteria is mostly theoretical, stochastic mostly theoretical, but mixed integer programming and heuristics are widely used in decision making, widely used. And in a way, given my age, I was usually at the front of each of these developments. And in Chile, we work with the companies, really application. That's why we own the Edelman. We work with companies. We started using a track scheduling system, then short-term harvesting, then location of machinery, then tactical planning, long-range planning. We had five systems heavily used by the forest companies, and they're still being used, some of those. Rafael Epstein, who was my partner there, is chairing, directing this work. Obviously, it's changed completely with new technologies, but some of the systems that were used then are still being used 30 years later, and they've been exported. When we competed the Edelman, we could show this is being used in Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, South Africa. In South Africa, Mondi of the main companies won the logistics prize of South Africa using our track scheduling system. So I think those two things, starting with real applications for forests, the long-range planning was there, but all the rest, and the mixed integer tactical planning, but the short-term track scheduling, short-term harvesting, and machine location, that was completely new. That was one thing. And the other is always working in new areas. For example, in the 80s, 90s, ecology became important. So you had one, to make it easy, one special important rule that's valid. If you harvest one area, maybe 40 hectares, you cannot harvest any neighboring areas until this one grows. And that leads to difficult combinatorial problems. And I worked a lot on that. They don't really use the difficult exact algorithms. They use mostly heuristics, but it's being used. Mm-hmm. I've worked with lots of people on that. And at that time, I wrote most of the state-of-the-art papers with colleagues. I would read everything. I started meetings, within INFORMS. I started the area of operations research in forestry. There was a community in operations research interested in forestry. There was a community in forestry interested in doing OR methods, and I put them together. So that was maybe 25 years ago, and now they're still working together. I mean, in the different meetings, forestry or INFORMS, people mingle.
Well, that's great to hear. You were also finalists of the Edelman Award in two other occasions, one involving a shipping application and the other involving soccer. Can you comment on both of them, please?
Well, given our success in forestry with the companies in Chile, and let me add something, which was a very nice recognition. ENRI, which is a section of INFORMS of Natural Resources and Energy, just gave out prizes for career prizes. And they gave me the first time prize for natural resources. In a way, recognizing, okay, this is the guy old enough to have started all this stuff.
So it's sort of a lifetime achievement award.
Yes.
You got. Ah, congratulations on that.
Yeah, this happened a year ago.
Right.
Now, given our success in forestry, the mining industry came to us. Codelco, which is a state-owned but run privately. It's the largest copper company in the world, I think. And what we built for them, again with Rafael, and he's running it now, was basically a model both for underground and open pit mines on how to plan 30 years ahead, how the extraction is going to be. And basically we divide the mine in areas of 30 by 30 by 30 meters, and we have many rules on, I'm not going to details on how will you extract, what will be your sequence of extracting. And we published a paper on operations research, and for that, let's see how much the company has gained for us. And in 2010, I think, or 2008, we could prove that Codelco had won $100 million thanks to our system. And they're still using it, and now also Rafael has worked with operational decisions, like how the trains, underground trains, should be sequenced. So that was important. And then the shipping company, look, oh, these guys did forestry and mining, and Sudamericana Apores was a worldwide, global company. It was the largest logistics company in Latin America, and the main business is containers. And they had a problem with the empty containers. Usually, China exports a lot more than the US. So once you have the containers in New York, how do you ship them back to? And we did a model for them, and which was started using in 2010, and we completed the element. So you have to prove, okay, how much you gain, and we could prove that 2010, the company got an extra $80 million, which was half the profit of the year.
Very, very impressive.
Uh-huh. And then football, I mean, we're all football fans. In 2004, Nemhauser, everybody knows George.
Yeah.
He came to Chile, he gave it to some conference, he gave a talk on, obviously, it's mixed into the programming. And I asked him, George, I know you do applied work. This is engineering. Give us also a talk on applied work. And I thought he was going to talk about, he's done things about scheduling in planes, in air companies. But he had a small company which scheduled the baseball in the US. He gave us that talk. And we thought, wow, maybe we could do this in Chile. And he gave an interview for El Mercurio, the main newspaper. And then we said, we'll propose to the Federation, Football Federation, to do this. And in all the world, basically, they do it just by chance. And in Chile, in 2004, by chance, the main match was the first week. And nobody was paying much attention. Yeah. Very few people went. So we went there, gave him a talk. We can schedule when you want. All the games, the important games in the middle, not the games where you think they're going to fight for the championship towards the end. If a stadium is in repairs, don't send important teams there, things like that. And we do the first year we're doing free. And they bought the idea. And since 2005, their football schedule in Chile is done by our system. I had to leave the team in 2013 because I became member of the board of my club, and there was a conflict of interest, but they're still doing it. And they scheduled the qualifying for the World Cups, the last three World Cups.
Wow.
Which was a difficult problem because of all the conditions they wanted. And several countries proposed methods, our group proposed, and that was accepted. So we competed in 2017, I think, for the Edelman, we're finalists. And what was interesting is we saw the finalists, UPS, who finally won. I mean, they had a great transportation plan of the truck, of the vehicles, which gave them $500 million over an already very good one. Said, as a business, I mean, we gave football $6 million, uh-huh, which is nice because the whole business is $150 million, but we cannot compete. Uh-huh. So we said, we're going to compete football as a passion, not as a business. And we oriented all the presentation to passion. And we always work with a TV production company. It came out beautifully. And we knew we entered the six, there were six projects finalists. Uh-huh. We entered number five. And the presentation was so nice that the chair of the board said, I wish I had another prize to give you also.
That's so nice. That's nice of them. Yeah. Right. Well, after so many years of academic activity in Chile, you still remain very active. Recently, you were the director of a Center of Excellence in Chile for 12 years. And how do you find the motivation to keep on doing great work?
Well, no, you have phases. I started there with a smaller grant. 5 years, a group of maybe 20 researchers. Then we applied for a larger grant, which is $3 million a year. And I ran it for 12 years. At that point, it's enough. It was 4 years ago, some younger person. I keep doing research. I don't take more bigger responsibilities now. That's for the younger people. It's fantastic. I mean, it's enjoyable. It's entertaining. I find that if you live without passion, it's boring.
Yeah.
I could think of other things that I could be interested, like playing bridge, which I did when I was in university, but now I don't have time anymore for it. So far, working in research has been very exciting for me. And I enjoy doing it. I enjoy talking to people, to young people. But it depends on, everybody's different. Some people at some point give it up and do something else. A friend of mine went into painting.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I'm happy doing this. But already, for example, teaching is not longer exciting for me.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of got tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, this year is the first year I'm not teaching. I want a sabbatical from teaching. Research, fine. I've got large projects for research. In one very large project with other 30 European institutions on forest fires, which is really funded. I'm working with a team of maybe, I don't know, six senior researchers, plus about 15 students.
Wow.
That's interesting. Forest fires are a big problem. Everybody knows it, especially with climate change.
Uh-huh.
So, and they have good simulation systems that once a fire starts, how it's going to develop, given the weather, winds, whatever is there, what type of trees, etc. And so they know in which direction they should put their efforts to resist the fire, the crews, the plane. What we're doing is called fuel management. How do you manage a forest before the fire starts? You don't know where it's going to start, how it's going to spread, but we have systems which sort of use machine learning for the ignitions. We have a great stochastic simulation model, which is similar to the other simulation models, but has the advantage. It's very, very fast. And what the others don't, it links very well into decision-making models. So instead of making up a solution and then testing it, it optimizes right away. Mm-hmm. And we're working on that. We're working in Chile, working with people in Catalonia. We want to work with people in Canada. All this was stopped because of the virus. I mean, we're going really strong ahead until 2 years ago. Now we hope we can start doing it.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to go to Spain next in March. We hope the virus will allow us to go because we have been working with them to install our developer system in Catalonia.
Yeah.
So that's my main research now, forest fires from a quantitative data science perspective. We think artificial intelligence is going to play a big role now. Reinforcement learning combined with optimization, I think, is going to be a tool we'll use, which is coming
yeah
up.
Very exciting to hear that. I'm very glad that you still have that, you know, passion and you know, the enthusiasm to keep on going, and it's great. You mentioned you like bridge. Just some fun fact. My dad also likes bridge, and in the 90s or so, he went to Santiago to attend a championship in bridge. Yeah, a bridge.
So it was good. No, no. I was very mediocre. Just
no. He went to watch, not to play.
Ah, no, but still, no. I mean, if he could understand what was going on, he was a serious player.
Yeah.
He played for fun.
I think he started playing when he was doing PhD in Canada, and he got books, and he was really interested. Actually, I'm not sure whether he started in India or not, but anyway, that's another story. So you became a member of the U.S. Academy of Engineering around a decade ago, and it seems that you have a couple of nice stories regarding the ceremony. Yeah.
Well, it's a huge honor. I think there are maybe 15, 18 Latin Americans from all the fields in engineering there. And I was inducted maybe 7 years ago or so. And they told me, look, there's going to be one dinner for all the new members, then a big dinner for everybody, and it's tuxedo. So I talked to my friends there, said, oh, don't worry, come one day before, you can rent a tuxedo. And I said, no. I watched the James Bond movies, Michael Craig, he looks great in a tuxedo. I won't like that. So I went to a tailor here to make a tuxedo for exactly, and really it worked. I mean, I look great in a tuxedo. The best I can look. I'm not Michael Craig. I'm not Daniel Craig or James Bond. But it was fun. I looked at the pictures myself in tuxedo, and really it's worthwhile. I understand. Frack, you know, frack smoke? No, that looks awful with the long tails. Uh-huh. No, that was like a penguin. But tuxedo, if you ever have a chance, not in Chile, I could never wear it in Chile or you in Brazil. But if you have an occasion to wear a tuxedo, do it.
So you feel more powerful and...
I mean, you look great. I mean, the best you can look.
During the ceremony, an interesting incident happened. Someone offered you a business card and you did not really pay attention.
I was sitting at a table. There were maybe, I don't know, lots of people, maybe, I don't know, 300 people, 500 people. And opposite, there were like typically 10 table for 10 people. And opposite mine was a gentleman there. And at some point he stood up and came to me and said, I like your work. That was very nice. Nice work. I said, thank you very much. I didn't really pay that much attention. Then he gave me his card and realized he was CEO of Bank of America and president of the Academy of Engineering.
Wow.
Wow. So I stood up and went to him again. Like to pay homage. Such an important guy would say your work is nice. And then I thought, look, why is it so important that important people pay attention to you? If the card had said, I mean, manager of a small company, you would have, that's it. And yeah, it's ego, whatever. I mean, but I couldn't resist. I mean, if this guy is so important, says something. I had to have a few more words. I mean, we talked for 2 minutes maybe. What do you do? I mean, chatting.
Yes.
So I thought that was, but it tells you, I mean, this is a weakness we have. I mean, we want important people to pay attention to us.
Yeah, and you want to impress them, you want to look good, and...
Fortunately, I don't do that much. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about it. At some point, a colleague of mine told me, you have a huge network. And I said, what network? I have lots of friends. I never thought about building a network, which now is obvious. You're a young researcher, you have to build a network, you work at it. I had no idea that networks were important. But I like talking to people, and I met friends at some point, whenever they asked me, okay, why don't you write a book, handbook, and the best people need to write the chapter. It was easy. I would just write to all my friends, okay, write a chapter on this. And I didn't realize I had a network. And for me, one of the great things of academia is all the friends you make along your life, visiting there. I have friends everywhere. And if it turns out it's also a network, fine. But I think it's much better if you start being friends with people and enjoying being with them.
Yeah. It is clear that you care a lot for the people you interact with. And it's nice to hear your views on friendship and collaboration that it just goes beyond the networking purposes. It's about, you know, interacting and being, you know, happy and, you know, enthusiastic about collaborating with friends. And it feels better, don't you think? It feels more human in a way, right?
Yeah. Right. Yes.
Yeah. Any plans of retirement? Do you intend to move to California to stay close to your son, who is a professor at Stanford?
We haven't really thought much about it. I realize that at my age, it's not going to last forever. When you are 45 like you...
No, I'm 38. Come on.
38. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah,
38. That's okay.
My son is 45. Uh-huh. You still think, I mean, it's going to go forever. At my age, you know, it's just a few more years. And there must be some way in which you sort of start slowing down. But while I think about it, I still haven't reached the point. I mean, with all these projects, it's still very intense. I would prefer to have less, but it's there, so I have to do it. And I enjoy it. But at some point, which I thought would be much earlier in my career, I have to start thinking, okay, slow down and take up something else. It could be bridge, it could be literature, movies, things I like, history. But friends tell me, look, we've retired, you have to start with something else. I just don't have the time. Join a movie club, join a history club, start playing bridge. And it's still there. Yeah, at some point I'll have to start doing it. But I mean, you live a day at a time and things will happen as they happen. My parents, they were very active until 90, they were 90. Mm-hmm. So I hope I inherited the genes. So I don't know. It's clearly not the same as being 38 like you, where you have your whole life and most of your life ahead of you. And you're still, I'm obviously a lot of time past my prime. Your prime is still ahead of you. So, I mean, it's a different way. And I remember how life looked for me when I was 40.
Uh-huh.
And now it's very different, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to leave a message to the young OR researchers from Latin America?
The first thing is, if you're a researcher, you must have passion for it. You must get excited. You should enjoy working with people. Once you start getting older, you should have as a duty to help younger academics. Hopefully you'll have an impact in what you do, either academically, with people, or in the country. For me, it's important to have an impact in the world with applied projects also. And it's a very enjoyable life. If you really like research, academia, my son at some point said, I like your life, your style of life. And that's how he became, I suppose, part of the reason he became an academic. It's a beautiful life. And make the most of it and enjoy it. You have to enjoy it and be passionate. Otherwise, it's dull. If you take it as a job, no, then go to work for a company.
Sometimes the young students might face some obstacles, some difficulties. And what is your advice when they come across those situations?
Well, there is a point where you probably have to make a decision. Am I really passionate about it? And obviously, am I talented enough? I mean, it's a point. Some people are very good at managing things. Other people are good at research. And if you need to have the talent. I remember having a classmate who was the best student in my class. And he never became a good researcher. After a few years at some US university, he went to a company.
I've seen that happening many times.
He was excellent at doing things that the professor told him to do, but he didn't have the drive to start with new ideas.
Yeah.
And you have to realize that, okay, if you don't have that, if you don't have the creativity, you will have it in other places. You might be a great manager or whatever, or you might be an entrepreneur, which requires different talents, different strengths. So try to make a good decision, do a good analysis. Mm-hmm. Is this what I really want? Is this what I'm really talented at? And maybe not. Maybe you should quit. Mm-hmm. For example, students come, say, well, I don't know, maybe academia, maybe business. How many hours a week do you have to work in academia? So mm-hmm. I tell them, go to business. Mm-hmm. If you have to think it's going to be a lot of work and you're counting the hours, then no. You don't have the passion for research, go to other fields.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you do like it and you have the talent, it's a great life.
Right. Well, Andres, it was a pleasure to have you here. I enjoyed our conversation very much. I would also like to take the opportunity to thank you for everything you've done on behalf of the Latin American OR community. You're such a great guy, and I hope there are other Andres rising up in the next years. And once again, muchas gracias. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anand, for inviting me. It's a big honor to be on your program. And it's been delightful. We've talked several times. It's been a delight. And I hope at some point we'll get together physically and have a good drink and dinner together.
Yeah. And you're, of course, most welcome to visit us here in João Pessoa. This time, if you come by Recife, please make sure you just do some detour and come here.
I certainly will. Right. Thank you again.
Thanks, Andres. And I hope to meet you soon in the next years. Ciao.
Likewise. Bye. Bye. Ciao.